kids in the passenger seat, and she said, "Larry did something to me today that made me feel uncomfortable." And I said, "Well, what do you mean?" "Well, he, you know, touched me." And I said, "Well, touched you where?" And she said, "Down there." And the whole time, you know what she's saying, but you're trying to rationalize that it can't be that.
She called her husband and asked him if he had left the room at any time during the appointment. He said he hadn't. Here's what a father of another victim told the reporters on Believed.
"And she's sitting in the car, very quiet and depressed, and saying, 'Dad, he's not helping my back pain. Let's not go anymore.' But this is Larry. This is the gymnastics doctor. If he can't cure her, nobody will cure her. Only God has more skills than Larry. Be patient, honey. It's going to take time. Good things take time. That's what we always taught our kids." So I would say, "Okay, we're going to go again next week. And we're going to go again the following week. And then you will start seeing the progress." She said, "Okay, Dad, you know. I trust your judgment."
The fact that Nasser was doing something monstrous is exactly what makes the parents' position so difficult. If Nasser had been rude to their daughters, they would have spoken up immediately. If their daughters had said to them on the way home that they had smelled alcohol on Nasser's breath, most parents would have filed an immediate complaint. It is not impossible to imagine that doctors are occasionally rude or drunk. Default to truth becomes an issue when we're forced to choose between two alternatives, one of which is likely and the other of which is impossible to imagine. Default to truth biases us in favor of the most likely interpretation. Scott Carmichael believed Anna Montes, right up to the point where believing her became absolutely impossible. The parents did the same thing, not because they were negligent, but because this is how most human beings are wired. Many of the women he had abused, in fact, defended Nasser. They couldn't see past default to truth either. Trine Gonzar was treated 856 times by Nasser during her gymnastics career. When one of her teammates came to Gonzar and said that Nasser had put his fingers inside her, Gonzar tried to reassure her. "He does that to me all the time." When the Indianapolis Star broke the Nasser story, Gonzar stood by him. She was convinced he would be exonerated. It was all a big mix-up. When did she finally change her mind? Only when the evidence against Nasser became overwhelming. At Nasser's trial, when Gonzar joined the chorus of his victims in testifying against him, she finally gave in to her doubts.
"I had to make an extremely hard choice this week, Larry. I had to choose whether to continue supporting you through this or to support them, the girls. I choose them, Larry. I choose to love them and protect them. I choose to stop caring for you and supporting you. I choose to look you in the face and tell you that you hurt us. You hurt me. I hope you will see it from me in my eyes today, that I believed in you always. Until I couldn't anymore. I hope you cry like we cry. I hope you feel bad for what you've done. I hope more than anything each day these girls can feel less pain. I hope you want that for us. But this is goodbye to you, Larry. And this time it's time for me to close the door. It's time for me to stand up for these little girls and not stand behind you anymore, Larry. Goodbye, Larry. May God bless your dark, broken soul."
"I believed in you always until I couldn't anymore." Isn't that an almost perfect statement of default to truth? Default to truth operates even in a case where the perpetrator had 37,000 child porn images on his hard drive, and where he had been accused countless times by numerous people over the course of his career. The Nassar case was open and shut, and still there were doubts. Now imagine the same scenario, only in a case that isn't open and shut. That's the Sandusky case. After the accusations against Sandusky were made public, one of his staunchest defenders was a former Second Mile participant named Alan Myers. When the Pennsylvania police were interviewing former Second Mile kids in an attempt to corroborate the allegations against Sandusky, they contacted Myers, and he was adamant. Myers said that he does not believe the allegations that had been made, and that the accuser is only out to get some money, the police report read. Myers continues to be in touch with Sandusky 1 to 2 times a week by telephone. Myers told the police that he had showered in the locker room with Sandusky many times after workouts, and nothing untoward had ever happened. 2 months later, Myers went further. He walked into the offices of Sandusky's attorney and made a stunning revelation. After reading the details of McQueary's story, he realized that he had been the boy in the shower that night. Curtis Everhart, an investigator for Sandusky's lawyer, wrote a synopsis of his interview with Myers. It is worth quoting at length. "I asked the specific question, did Jerry ever touch you in a manner that you felt to be improper or caused you to feel concern about his invading your personal space?" Myers answered with a very pronounced, "Never, ever did anything like that ever occur." Myers stated, "Never in my life while with Jerry did I ever feel uncomfortable or violated. I think of Jerry as the father I never had." Myers stated on senior night at a West Branch High School football game, "I asked Jerry to walk onto the field with my mother. It was announced on the loudspeaker, 'Father Jerry Sandusky,' along with my mother's name. I invited Jerry and Dottie to my wedding. Why would I ask Jerry, my father figure at senior night, ask Jerry and Dottie to be at my wedding, and the school asked me to ask Jerry to speak at my graduation, which he did, if there was a problem? Why would I travel to games, go to his house, and make all the trips if Jerry had assaulted me? If that had happened, I would want to be as far away from him as possible." Myers described the night in question to investigators. "I would usually work out 1 or 2 days a week, but this particular night is very clear in my mind. We were in the shower, and Jerry and I were slapping towels at each other, trying to sting each other. I would slap the walls and would slide on the shower floor, which I am sure you could have heard from the wooden locker area. While we were engaged in fun, as I have described, I heard the sound of a wooden locker door close, a sound I have heard before. I never saw who closed the locker." The grand jury report says, "Coach McQueary said he observed Jerry and I engaged in sexual activity. This is not the truth, and McQueary is not telling the truth. Nothing occurred that night in the shower." But a few weeks later, Myers signed up with a lawyer who represented a number of alleged Sandusky victims. Myers then made a statement to police in which he completely changed his tune. "He was one of Sandusky's victims," he now said. You could be forgiven if you find this confusing. The boy in the shower was the most important witness in the whole case. Prosecutors had been searching high and low for him because he would be the final nail in Sandusky's coffin. So finally he surfaces, denies anything happened, then almost immediately flips, saying actually something did happen. So did Myers become the key prosecution witness in the Sandusky trial? That would make sense. He was the most important piece in the whole puzzle. No. The prosecution left him at home because they had no confidence in his story. The prosecution's report on Alan Myers is a doozy. An investigator named Michael Coricelli spoke to Myers' lawyer, who told him that Myers now claimed to have been raped repeatedly by Sandusky. The prosecution tried to re-interview Myers. Myers' lawyer would not let them. Finally, his lawyer produced a 3-page account allegedly written by Myers detailing his abuse at the hands of Sandusky. The prosecution team read the account and concluded that it hadn't been written by Myers at all, but rather by his lawyer. At that point, the prosecution gave up and walked away from one of the most important figures in the entire case. The only time Myers ever appeared in court was to testify at Sandusky's appeal. Sandusky had asked him to testify in the vain hope that Myers would revert to his original position and say that nothing happened in the shower. Myers did not. Instead, as Sandusky's lawyers read back to Myers each of the statements he had made less than a year before about Sandusky's innocence, Myers sat there stone-faced and shrugged at everything, including a picture of him standing happily next to Sandusky. "Who are the people in the photo?" he was asked. "Myers, that's myself and your client. Defense, and when was that picture taken, if you know?" "Myers, that I do not remember." It was a picture of Myers and Sandusky at Myers' wedding. In all, he said he didn't recall 34 times. Then there was Brett Swisher Houts, a second-mile child with whom Sandusky had been very close. He was probably the most devastating witness at Sandusky's trial. House told of being repeatedly assaulted and abused, of dozens of lurid sexual encounters with Sandusky during his teenage years, in showers and saunas and hotel rooms.
"Mr. Houts, can you tell the ladies and gentlemen of the jury approximately how many times the defendant in either the East Area locker room or the Lash Building shower put his penis in your mouth?"
"It would have to be 40 times, at least."
"Did you want him to do it?"
"No."
"On any of those occasions?"
"No."
Then Sandusky's wife, Dottie, was called to the stand. She was asked when she and her husband last saw Brett House.
"I think it was 3 years ago or 2 years ago. I'm not sure."
The stories House told of his abuse were alleged to have happened in the 1990s. Dottie Sandusky was saying that 2 decades after being brutally and repeatedly victimized, House decided to drop by for a visit.
"Can you tell us about that?"
"Yeah. Jerry got a phone call. It was Brett. He said, 'I want to come over. I want to bring my girlfriend and my baby for you to see.' The baby was like 2 years old, and they came over, and my friend Elaine Steinbacher was there, and we went and got Kentucky Fried Chicken and had dinner, and it was a very pleasant visit."
This is a much more perplexing example than Trine Gonzar in the Nassar case. Gonzar never denied that something happened in her sessions with Nassar. She chose to interpret his actions as benign, for entirely understandable reasons, up until the point when she listened to the testimony of her fellow gymnasts at Nassar's trial. Sandusky, by contrast, wasn't practicing some ambiguous medical procedure. He is supposed to have engaged in repeated acts of sexual violence, and his alleged victims didn't misinterpret what he was doing to them. They acted as if nothing had ever happened. They didn't confide in their friends. They didn't write anguished accounts in their journals. They dropped by, years later, to show off their babies to the man who raped them. They invited their rapists to their weddings. One victim showered with Sandusky and called himself the luckiest boy in the world. Another boy emerged with a story after months of prodding by a therapist that couldn't even convince a grand jury. Sexual abuse cases are complicated, wrapped in layers of shame and denial and clouded memories. But few high-profile cases were as complicated as Jerry Sandusky's. Now think about what that complication means for those who must make sense of all that swirling contradiction. There were always doubts about Sandusky. But how do you get to enough doubts when the victims are happily eating Kentucky Fried Chicken with their abuser? So, McQuarrie goes to see his boss, Joe Paterno, on a Saturday. An alarmed Paterno sits down with Tim Curley and Gary Schultz the following day, Sunday. They immediately call the university's council and then brief the university president, Graham Spanier, on Monday. Then Curley and Schultz call in Mike McQuarrie. You can only imagine what Curley and Schultz are thinking as they listen to him. If this really was a rape, why didn't you break it up? If what you saw was so troubling, why didn't anyone, including your family friend, who is a doctor, tell the police? And if you, Mike McQuarrie, were so upset about what you saw, why did you wait so long to tell us? Curley and Schultz then call the university's outside counsel. But McQuarrie hasn't given them much. They instinctively reach, as we all do, for the most innocent of explanations. Maybe Jerry was just being goofy Jerry. Here is how, at trial, the Penn State lawyer, Wendell Courtney, recounted his conversation with Gary Schultz.
I asked at some point along the way whether this horseplay involving Jerry and a young boy, whether there was anything sexual in nature, and he indicated to me that there was not, to his knowledge. My vision, at least when it was being described to me in talking with Mr. Schultz, was that it was, you know, a young boy with the showers on, a lot of water in the shower area, group shower area, just kind of, you know, running and sliding on the floor.
Are you sure he didn't say slapping sound or anything sexual in nature at all?
I am quite positive. He never said to me slapping sounds or anything sexual in nature that was reported going on in the shower.
Courtney said he thought about it and considered the worst case scenario. This was, after all, a man and a boy in the shower after hours. But then he thought of what he knew of Jerry Sandusky. As someone that goofed around with second-mile kids all the time in public, and he defaulted to that impression. Schultz then testifies how he went to see University President Spanier.
You did tell Graham Spanier it was horseplay?
Yeah.
When did you tell him that?
Well, the first report that we got that was passed on to us is horsing around. Jerry Sandusky was seen in the shower horsing around with a kid, and I think that word is repeated to President Spanier that, you know, that he was horsing around.
Spanier listened to Schultz and asked two questions. Are you sure that's how it was described to you, as horsing around? He said yes. Then Spanier asked again, are you sure that's all that was said to you? Spanier barely knew Sandusky. Penn State has thousands of employees. One of them, now retired, was spotted in a shower? I remember, for a moment, sort of figuratively scratching our heads and thinking about what's an appropriate way to follow up on horsing around, Spanier said later. I had never gotten a report like that before. If Harry Markopoulos had been president of Penn State during the Sandusky case, of course, he would never have defaulted like this to the most innocent of explanations. A man in a shower? With a boy? The kind of person who saw through Madoff's deceit a decade before anyone else would have leapt at once to the most damning conclusion. How old was the kid? What were they doing there at night? Wasn't there a weird case with Sandusky a couple years ago? But Graham Spanier is not Harry Markopoulos. He opted for the likeliest explanation, that Sandusky was who he claimed to be. Does he regret not asking one more follow-up question, not quietly asking around? Of course he does. But defaulting to truth is not a crime. It is a fundamentally human tendency. Spanier behaved no differently from the mountain climber and Scott Carmichael and Nat Simons and Trine Gonzar and, for that matter, virtually every one of the parents of the gymnasts treated by Larry Nassar. Weren't some of those parents in the room when Nassar was abusing their own children? Hadn't their children said something wasn't right? Why did they send their child back to Nassar again and again? Yet in the Nassar case, no one has ever suggested that the parents of the gymnasts belong in jail for failing to protect their offspring from a predator. We accept the fact that being a parent requires a fundamental level of trust in the community of people around your child. If every coach is assumed to be a pedophile, then no parent would ever let their child leave the house, and no sane person would ever volunteer to be a coach. We default to truth even when that decision carries terrible risks because we have no choice. Society cannot function otherwise. And in those rare cases where trust ends in betrayal, those victimized by default to truth deserve our sympathy, not our censure. Tim Curley and Gary Schultz were charged first. Two of the most important officials at one of the most prestigious state universities in the United States were placed under arrest. Spanier called his senior staff together for an emotional meeting. He considered Penn State to be a big family. These were his friends. When they told him that the shower incident was probably just horseplay, he believed they were being honest. "You're going to find that everyone is going to distance themselves from Gary and Tim," Spanier said. But he would not. "You've worked with them every day of your life, and I have for the last 16 years," he remembers saying. "If any of you operate according to how we have always agreed to operate at this university, honestly, openly, with integrity, always doing what's in the best interests of the university, if you were falsely accused of something, I would do the same thing for any of you in here. I want you to know that. None of you should ever fear doing the right thing or being accused of wrongdoing when you knew you were doing the right thing, because this university would back them up." This is why people liked Graham Spanier. It's why he had such a brilliant career at Penn State. It's why you and I would want to work for him. We want Graham Spanier as our president, not Harry Markopoulos, armed to the teeth, waiting for a squad of government bureaucrats to burst through the front door. This is the first of the ideas to keep in mind when considering the death of Sandra Bland. We think we want our guardians to be alert to every suspicion. We blame them when they default to truth. When we send people like Graham Spanier to jail, we send a message to all of those in positions of authority about the way we want them to make sense of strangers, without stopping to consider the consequences of sending that message. But we're getting ahead of ourselves. Part 3, Transparency. Chapter 6, The Friends Fallacy. By its fifth season, Friends was well on its way to becoming one of the most successful television shows of all time. It was one of the first great hangout comedies. Six friends, Monica, Rachel, Phoebe, Joey, Chandler, and Ross, live in a chaotic jumble in downtown Manhattan. Couple and decouple, flirt and fight, but mostly just talk, endlessly and hilariously. The season begins with Ross getting married to a non-Friends outsider. By mid-season, the relationship will be over, and by season's end, he will be back in the arms of Rachel. Phoebe gives birth to triplets and takes up with a police officer. And most consequentially, Monica and Chandler fall in love, a development that creates an immediate problem because Monica is Ross's sister and Chandler is Ross's best friend, and neither of them have the courage to tell Ross what is happening. Let me cue up episode 15, titled "The One with the Girl Who Hits Joey." At the beginning of episode 15, Ross looks out his window at the apartment across the way and spots his sister Monica in a romantic embrace with Chandler. He's thunderstruck. He runs to Monica's apartment and tries to barge in, but the chain is on her door, so he sticks his face into the 6-inch gap.
"Chandler! Chandler! Chandler! I saw what you were doing through the window! I saw what you were doing to my sister! Now get out of here!"
Chandler, alarmed, tries to escape out the window. Monica holds him back.
"I can handle Ross.
Ross runs inside, lunges at Chandler, and starts to chase him around the kitchen table, shouting, What the hell are you doing? Chandler hides behind Monica. Joey and Rachel rush in.
Hey, what's going on?
Well, I think Ross knows about me and Monica. Dude, he's right there.
I thought you were my best friend. This is my sister. My best friend and my sister. I cannot believe this.
Did you follow all that? A standard Friends season had so many twists and turns of plot and variations of narrative and emotion that it seems as though viewers would need a flowchart to make sure they didn't lose their way. In reality, however, nothing could be further from the truth. If you've ever watched an episode of Friends, you'll know that it is almost impossible to get confused. The show is crystal clear. How clear? I think you can probably follow along, even if you turn off the sound. The second of the puzzles that began this book was the bail problem. How is it that judges do a worse job of evaluating defendants than a computer program, even though judges know a lot more about defendants than the computer does? This section of Talking to Strangers is an attempt to answer that puzzle, beginning with the peculiar fact of how transparent television shows such as Friends are. To test this idea about the transparency of Friends, I call up a psychologist named Jennifer Fugate, who teaches at the University of Massachusetts in Dartmouth. Fugate is an expert in FACTS, which stands for Facial Action Coding System. In FACTS, every one of the 43 distinctive muscle movements in the face is assigned a number called an action unit. People like Fugate, who are trained in FACTS, can then look at someone's facial expressions and score them, just as a musician can listen to a piece of music and translate it into a series of notes on the page. So, for example, take something called a Pan Am smile, the kind of smile a flight attendant gives you when he or she is trying to be polite. When you give that kind of smile, you pull up the corners of your lips using what's called the zygomaticus major muscle. But you leave the rest of your face impassive. That's why the smile looks fake. It's a smile without any kind of facial elaboration. In the FACTS, the Pan Am smile using the zygomaticus major is scored as action unit 12. By contrast, there's what's called a Duchenne smile. It's a genuine smile where cheeks move up and there are telltale crow's feet around the eyes. In technical terms, a Duchenne smile is action unit 12 plus action unit 6, meaning that it's a facial movement involving the outer portion of the orbicularis oculi muscle. FACTS is an extraordinarily sophisticated tool. It involves cataloging in exact detail thousands of muscular movements, some of which may appear on the face for no more than a fraction of a second. The FACTS manual is over 500 pages long. If Fugate had done a FACTS analysis of the entire Girl Who Hits Joey episode, it would have taken her weeks. So I asked her to focus just on that opening scene. Ross sees Chandler and Rachel embracing, then rushes over in anger. Here's what she found. When Ross looks through the cracked door and sees his sister in a romantic embrace with his best friend, his face shows action units 10 plus 16 plus 25 plus 26. That's the upper lip raiser, the lower lip depressor, parted lips, and jaw drop. In the FACTS system, muscular movements are also given an intensity measure from A to E, with A being mildest and E strongest. All of Ross's four muscle movements in that moment are strong E's. If you go back and watch that Friends episode and freeze the screen at the moment when Ross looks through the doorframe, you'll see exactly what the FACTS coders are describing. He has an unmistakable look on his face of anger and disgust. Ross then rushes into Monica's apartment. The tension in the scene is accelerating, and so are Ross's emotions. Now his face reads 4C plus 5D plus 7C plus 10E plus 16E plus 25E plus 26E. Again, 4 E's.
That's a brow lowerer. And then a 7 is an eye squint. It's called lid tightener.
This is Fugate.
He's kind of scowling and closing his eyes at the same time. So that's a stereotypic anger. And then it's very classic for disgust, both a 9 and a 10. And then the 16 sometimes happens with that. That's a lower lip depressor. So that's when you push your bottom lip down so that you can see your bottom teeth.
In the episode, Monica tries to pretend nothing is amiss. She smiles at her brother, but it's a Pan Am smile, not a Duchenne smile. Some 12 and the barest, least plausible whisper of 6. Ross chases Chandler around the kitchen table. Chandler hides behind Monica, and as Ross approaches, he says,
"Look, we're not just messing around. I love her. Okay, I'm in love with her."
Then Monica reaches and takes Ross's hand.
"I'm so sorry that you had to find out this way. Sorry, but it's true. I love him too."
There's a long silence as Ross stares at the two of them, processing a storm of competing emotions. Then he bursts into a smile, hugs them both, and repeats himself, only this time happily.
"My best friend and my..."
As Monica breaks the news to her brother, Fugate scores her as 1C plus 2D plus 12D. The 1 and 2 in combination are sadness. She's raised the inner and outer parts of her eyebrows. 12D, of course, is the emotionally incomplete Pan Am smile.
She kind of gives, as strange as that sounds, is an indicator of sadness, but then happiness. And I think it kind of makes sense because she's apologizing, but then she's showing Ross, right, that she's actually okay with this.
Ross looks at his sister for a long beat. His face scores classic sadness. Then his face subtly shifts to 1E plus 12D. He's giving back to his sister the exact same mix of emotions she gave to him. Sadness combined with the beginnings of happiness. He's losing his sister, but at the same time, he wants her to know that he appreciates her joy. Fugate's facts analysis tells us that the actors in Friends make sure that every emotion their character is supposed to feel in their heart is expressed perfectly on their face. That's why you can watch the scene with the sound turned off and still follow along. The words are what make us laugh or what explain particular nuances of narrative, but the facial expressions of the actors are what carry the plot. The actors' performances in Friends are transparent. Transparency is the idea that people's behavior and demeanor, the way they represent themselves on the outside, provides an authentic and reliable window into the way they feel on the inside. It is the second of the crucial tools we use to make sense of strangers. When we don't know someone, or can't communicate with them, or don't have the time to understand them properly, we believe we can make sense of them through their behavior and demeanor. The idea of transparency has a long history. In 1872, 13 years after first presenting his famous treatise on evolution, Charles Darwin published The Expression of the Emotions in Man and Animals. Smiling and frowning and wrinkling our noses in disgust, he argued, were things that every human being did as a part of evolutionary adaptation. Accurately and quickly communicating our emotions to one another was of such crucial importance to the survival of the human species, he believed, that the face had developed into a kind of billboard for the heart. Darwin's idea is deeply intuitive. Children everywhere smile when they are happy, frown when they are sad, or giggle when they are amused, don't they? It isn't just people watching Friends in their living room in Cleveland, Toronto, or Sydney who can make sense of what Ross and Rachel are feeling. It's everyone. The bail hearings described in Chapter 2 are likewise an exercise in transparency. The judge does not correspond with the parties in a court case by email or call them up on the telephone. Judges believe that it's crucial to look at the people they're judging. A Muslim woman in Michigan was the plaintiff in a lawsuit a few years ago, and she came to court wearing the traditional niqab, a veil covering all but her eyes. The judge asked her to take it off. She refused. So the judge dismissed her case. He didn't think he could fairly adjudicate a disagreement between two parties when he couldn't see one of them. He told her, "One of the things that I need to do as I am listening to testimony is I need to see your face and I need to see what's going on. And unless you take that off, I can't see your face. And I can't tell whether you're telling me the truth or not. And I can't see certain things about your demeanor and temperament that I need to see in a court of law." Do you think the judge was right? I'm guessing many of you do. We wouldn't spend as much time as we do looking at people's faces if we didn't think there was something valuable to be learned. In novels, we read that his eyes widened in shock or her face fell in disappointment, and we accept without question that faces really do fall and eyes really do widen in response to the feelings of shock and disappointment. We can watch Ross and know what he feels with the sound off, because thousands of years of evolution have attuned us to expressions human beings make. We believe someone's demeanor is a window into their soul. But that takes us back to puzzle number two. Judges in bail hearings have a window into the defendant's soul, yet they are much worse at predicting who will reoffend than John Kleinberg's computer, which has a window into no one's soul. If real life were like Friends, judges would beat computers, but they don't. So maybe real life isn't like Friends. The Trobriand Islands lie 100 miles east of Papua New Guinea, in the middle of the Solomon Sea. The Trobriand Archipelago is tiny, home to 40,000 people. It's isolated and tropical. The people there fish and farm much as their ancestors did thousands of years ago, and their ancient customs have proven remarkably durable, even in the face of the inevitable encroachments of the 21st century. In the same way that car makers take new models to the Arctic to test them under the most extreme conditions possible, social scientists sometimes like to stress test hypotheses in places such as the Trobriands. If something works in London or New York and it works in the Trobriands, you could be pretty sure you're onto something universal, which is what sent two Spanish social scientists to the Trobriand Islands in 2013. Sergio Jarillo is an anthropologist. He had worked in the Trobriands before, and he knew the language and culture. Carlos Crivelli is a psychologist. He had spent the earliest part of his career testing the limits of transparency. Once he examined dozens of videotapes of judo fighters who had just won their matches to figure out when exactly they smiled. Was it at the moment of victory, or did they win, then smile? Another time, he watched videos of people masturbating to find out what their faces looked like at the moment of climax. Presumably, an orgasm is a moment of true happiness. Is that happiness evident and observable in the moment? In both cases, it wasn't, which didn't make sense if our emotions are really a billboard for the heart. These studies made Crivelli a skeptic, so he and Jarillo decided to put Darwin to the test. Jarillo and Crivelli started with 6 headshots of people looking happy, sad, angry, scared, and disgusted, with one final picture of someone with a neutral expression. Before they left for the Trobriands, the two men took their pictures to a primary school in Madrid and tried them out on a group of children. They put all 6 photos before a child and asked, "Which of these is the sad face?" Then they went to the second child and asked, "Which of these is the angry face?" And so on, cycling through all 6 pictures over and over again. The children had no difficulty at all with the exercise. Then Jarillo and Crivelli flew to the Trobriand Islands and repeated the process. The Trobrianders were friendly and cooperative. They had a rich, nuanced language, which made them an ideal test case for a study of emotion. Hario explained it to me at a cafe, where I met with him and Crivelli to discuss their study.
Sometimes, so to say that something has really surprised you in a positive way, they say it has enraptured my mind, or it has cut my mind. So, you know, so when you say, you know, when you repeat that, you say, well, has this thing cut your mind? It's like, well, no, this one is more like it has taken my stomach away.
People with phrases like, it's taken my stomach away, are not people who would be flummoxed by being asked to make sense of emotional truth. If Darwin was correct, the Trobrianders should be as good as the school children in Madrid at making sense of people's faces. Emotions are hardwired by evolution. That means people in the middle of the Solomon Sea must have the same operating system as people in Madrid. Right? Wrong. The Trobrianders struggled. All of the 113 schoolchildren identified the happiness face as a happiness face. But only 58% of the Trobrianders did, while 23% looked at a smiling face and called it neutral. And happiness is the emotion where there is the most agreement between the Trobrianders and the Spanish children. On everything else, the Trobrianders' idea of what emotion looks like on the outside appears to be totally different from our own.
I think that probably the thing that surprises the most is the fact that, you know, what we think in Western societies is a phase of a fear of somebody who's scared. It's a gasping phase. Turns out that, you know, like, is recognized in the Trobriand Islands more as a threat. In our culture, my face would be like, I'm scared of you. In their culture, that face is not the face of somebody who's scared, but it's the face of somebody who's trying to scare somebody else.
Somebody that is not scared, is threatening.
Or threatening.
Here, Crivelli mimed the gasping face, wide open eyes, the face from Edvard Munch's famous painting, The Scream. The sensation of fear for a Trobriand Islander is not any different from the fear that you or I feel. They get the same sick feeling in the pit of their stomach, but for some reason they don't show it in the same way we do. Anger was just as bad. You would think, wouldn't you, that everyone in the world would know what an angry face looks like. It's such a fundamental emotion, the hard eyes, the tight mouth. But anger baffled the Trobrianders. When looking at what Madrid schoolchildren knew as the angry face, 20% of Trobrianders called it a happy face. 17% called it a sad face. 30% called it a fearful face. 20% thought it was a sign of disgust, and only 7% identified it the way that nearly every Spanish schoolchild had.
You know, like they're frowning, or they use one of these big Ibacala, you know, like proverbs that say, like, you know, like means like his brow is dark, which obviously can translate as he's frowning, you know. But they wouldn't infer that means that this person is angry
all the time.
To make sure the Trobrianders weren't some kind of special case, Hario and Crivelli then traveled to Mozambique to study a group of isolated fishermen known as the Mwani. Once again, the results were dismal. The Mwani did marginally better than chance with the smiling faces, but they seemed baffled by sad faces and angry faces. Another group, led by Maria Gendron, traveled to the mountains of northwest Namibia to see whether the people there could accurately sort photographs into piles according to the emotional expression of the subject. They couldn't. Even historians have now gotten into the act. If you could go into a time machine and show the ancient Greeks and Romans pictures of modern-day people grinning broadly, would they interpret that expression the same way we do? Probably not. As classicist Mary Beard writes in her book, Laughter in Ancient Rome, this is not to say that Romans never curled up the edges of their mouths in a formation that would look to us much like a smile. Of course they did. But such curling did not mean very much in the range of significant social and cultural gestures in Rome. Conversely, other gestures, which would mean little to us, were much more heavily freighted with significance. If you staged a screening of that Friends episode for the Trobriand Islanders, they would see Ross confronting Chandler and think Chandler was angry and Ross was scared. They would get the scene completely wrong. And if you threw a Friends premiere in ancient Rome for Cicero and the Emperor and a bunch of their friends, they would look at the extravagant grimaces and contortions on the faces of the actors and think, what on earth? Okay, what about within a culture? If we limit ourselves to the developed world and forget about outliers and ancient Rome, do the rules of transparency now work? No, they don't. Imagine the following scenario. You're led down a long, narrow hallway into a dark room. There you sit and listen to a recording of a Franz Kafka short story, followed by a memory test on what you've just heard. You finish the test and step back into the corridor. But while you are listening to Kafka, a team has been hard at work. The corridor was actually made of temporary partitions. Now they've been moved to create a wide open space. The room has bright green walls. A single light bulb hangs from the ceiling, illuminating a bright red chair. And sitting in the chair is your best friend, looking solemn. You come out thinking you're going to be heading down the same narrow hallway, and boom, a room where a room isn't supposed to be, and your friend staring at you like a character in a horror film. Would you be surprised? Of course you would. And what would your face look like? Well, you wouldn't look the same as a Trobriand Islander would look in that situation, nor a citizen of ancient Rome. But within our culture, in this time and place, what surprise looks like is well established. There's a perfect example of surprise in that same Friends episode. Ross's roommate Joey rushes into Monica's apartment and discovers two of his best friends trying to kill each other. And his face tells you everything you need to know. Action Unit 1 plus 2, eyebrows shooting up, plus Action Unit 5, eyes going wide, plus Action Unit 25 plus 26, which is your jaw dropping. If you were very surprised, you'd make the Joey face, right? Wrong. Two German psychologists, Achim Schutzwall and Rainer Reisenstein, created the Kafka scenario and ran 60 people through it. Those 60 rated their feelings of surprise when they opened the door after their session with Kafka at 8.14 on a scale of 1 to 10. They were stunned. And when asked, almost all of them were convinced that surprise was written all over their faces. But it wasn't. Schutzwall and Reisenstein had a video camera in the corner, and they used it to code everyone's expressions in the same way Fugate had coded the Friends episode. In only 5% of the cases did they find wide eyes, shooting eyebrows, and dropped jaws. In 17% of the cases, they found two of those expressions. In the rest, they found some combination of nothing, a little something, and things such as knitted eyebrows that you wouldn't necessarily associate with surprise at all. The participants in all conditions grossly overestimated their surprise expressivity, Schutzwall and Reisenstein wrote. Why? They inferred their likely facial expressions to the surprising event from folk psychological beliefs about emotion-face associations. Folk psychology is the kind of crude psychology we glean from cultural sources, such as sitcoms. But that is not the way things happen in real life. Transparency is a myth, an idea we've picked up from watching too much television and reading too many novels where the hero's jaw dropped with astonishment or eyes went wide with surprise. The two psychologists go on to say, the participants apparently reasoned that since they felt surprise, and since surprise is associated with a characteristic facial display, they must have shown this display. In most cases, this inference was erroneous. I don't think that this mistake, expecting what is happening on the outside to perfectly match what is going on inside, matters with our friends. part of what it means to get to know someone is to come to understand how idiosyncratic their emotional expressions can be. My father was once in the shower in a vacation cottage that my parents had rented when he heard my mother scream. He came running to find a large young man with a knife to my mother's throat. What did he do? Keep in mind that this is a 70-year-old man, naked and dripping wet. He pointed at the assailant and said in a loud, clear voice, "Get out now!" And the man did. On the inside, my father was terrified. The most precious thing in his life, his beloved wife of half a century, was being held at knife point. But I doubt very much that fear showed on his face. His eyes didn't go wide with terror, and his voice didn't jump an octave. If you knew my father, you would have seen him in other stressful situations, and you would have come to understand that the frightened face, for whatever reason, was simply not part of his repertoire. In crisis, he turned deadly calm. But if you didn't know him, what would you have thought? Would you have concluded that he was cold, unfeeling? When we confront a stranger, we have to substitute an idea, a stereotype, for direct experience. And that stereotype is wrong all too often. By the way, do you know how the Trobianders show surprise? When Crivelli showed up, he had a little Apple iPod, and the islanders gathered around in admiration.
They were approaching me. I was showing them. They was doing... They were, like, freaking out, like, saying, and they were not doing, like...
He mimed a perfect AU1 plus 2 plus 5.
No, they were...
This is the explanation for the second of the puzzles in Chapter 2 about why computers do a much better job than judges at making bail decisions. The computer cannot see the defendant. Judges can. And it seems logical that that extra bit of information ought to make them better decision makers. Solomon, the New York State judge, could search the face of the person standing in front of him for evidence of mental illness, a glassy-eyed look, a troubled affect, aversion of the eyes. The defendant stands no further than 10 feet in front of him, and Solomon has the chance to get a sense of the person he is evaluating. But all that extra information isn't actually useful. Surprised people don't necessarily look surprised. People who have emotional problems don't always look like they have emotional problems. Some years ago, there was a famous case in Texas in which a young man named Patrick Dale Walker put a gun to his ex-girlfriend's head, only to have the gun jam as he pulled the trigger. The judge in his case set bail at $1 million, then lowered it to $25,000 after Walker had spent 4 days in jail on the grounds that this was long enough for him to cool off. Walker, the judge explained later, had nothing on his record, not even a traffic ticket. He was polite. He was a real low-key, mild-mannered young man. The kid, from what I understand, is a real smart kid. He was valedictorian of his class. He graduated from college. This was supposedly his first girlfriend. Most importantly, according to the judge, Walker showed remorse. The judge thought Walker was transparent. But what does showed remorse mean? Did he put on a sad face, cast his eyes down, and lower his head the way he had seen people show remorse on 1,000 television shows? And why do we think that if someone puts on a sad face, casts their eyes down, and lowers their head, then some kind of sea change has taken place in their heart? Life is not friends. Seeing Walker didn't help the judge. It allowed him to explain away the simple fact that Walker had put a gun to his girlfriend's head and failed to kill her only because the gun misfired. 4 months later, while out on bail, Walker shot his girlfriend dead. Kleinberg and his team write, "Whatever these unobserved variables are, that cause judges to deviate from the predictions, whether internal states, such as mood, or specific features of the case that are salient and overweighted, such as the defendant's appearance, they are not a source of private information so much as a source of mispredictions. The unobservables create noise, not signal. Translation? The advantage that the judge has over the computer isn't actually an advantage. Should we take the Kleinberg study to its logical conclusion? Should we hide the defendant from the judge? Maybe when a woman shows up in a courtroom wearing a niqab, the correct response isn't to dismiss her case. It's to require that everyone wear a veil. For that matter, it is also worth asking whether you should meet the babysitter in person before you hire her, or whether your employer did the right thing in scheduling a face-to-face interview before making you a job offer. But of course, we can't turn our backs on the personal encounter, can we? The world doesn't work if every meaningful transaction is rendered anonymous. I asked Judge Solomon if he would prefer not being able to see the defendant. There's a part of my brain that says I would prefer that, he said, because then the hard decisions to put someone in jail would feel less hard. But that's not right. You have a human being being taken into custody by the state, and the state has to justify why it's taking liberty away from a human, right? The transparency problem ends up in the same place as the default to truth problem. Our strategies for dealing with strangers are deeply flawed, but they are also socially necessary. We need the criminal justice system and the hiring process and the selection of babysitters to be human. But the requirement of humanity means that we have to tolerate an enormous amount of error. That is the paradox of talking to strangers. We need to talk to them, but we're terrible at it. And as we'll hear in the next two chapters, we're not always honest with one another about just how terrible at it we are. Chapter 7, A Short Explanation of the Amanda Knox Case. On the night of November 1st, 2007, Meredith Kircher was murdered by Rudy Goudet. After a mountain of argumentation, speculation, and controversy, his guilt is a certainty. Goudet was a shady character who had been hanging around the Italian city of Perugia, where Kircher, a college student, was living during a year abroad. Goudet had a criminal history. He admitted to being in Kircher's house the night of her murder and could only give the most implausible reasons for why. The crime scene was covered with his DNA. After Kircher's body was discovered, he immediately fled Italy for Germany. But Rudy Goudet was not the exclusive focus of the police investigation, nor anything more than an afterthought in the tsunami of media attention that followed the discovery of Kircher's body. The focus was instead on Kircher's roommate. Her name was Amanda Knox. She came home one morning and found blood in the bathroom. She and her boyfriend, Raffaele Solicito, called the police. The police came and found Kircher dead in her bedroom. Within hours, they added Knox and Solicito to their list of suspects. The crime, the police believed, was a drug and alcohol-fueled sex game gone awry, featuring Goudet, Solicito, and Knox. The three were arrested, charged, convicted, and sent to prison, with every step of the way chronicled obsessively by the tabloid press. A murder always gets people going. Bit of intrigue, bit of mystery, a whodunit. British journalist Nick Pisa says in the documentary Amanda Knox, one of a vast library of books, academic essays, magazine articles, movies, and news shows spawned by the case. And we have here this beautiful, picturesque hilltop town in the middle of Italy. It was a particularly gruesome murder. Throat slit, semi-naked, blood everywhere. I mean, what more do you want in a story? Other signature crime stories, such as the O.J. Simpson or JonBenet Ramsey cases, are just as enthralling when you rediscover them 5 or 10 years later. The Amanda Knox case is not. It is completely inexplicable in hindsight. There was never any physical evidence linking either Knox or her boyfriend to the crime. Nor was there ever a plausible explanation for why Knox, an immature, sheltered, middle-class girl from Seattle, would be interested in engaging in murderous sex games. The police investigation against her was revealed as shockingly inept. The analysis of the DNA evidence supposedly linking her and Solicito to the crime was completely botched. Her Italian prosecutor was wildly irresponsible, obsessed with fantasies about elaborate sex games. Yet it took a ruling by the Italian Supreme Court 8 years after the crime for Knox to be finally declared innocent. Even then, many otherwise intelligent, thoughtful people disagreed. When Knox was freed from prison, a large, angry crowd gathered in the Perugia town square to protest her release. The Amanda Knox case altogether makes no sense. I could give you a point-by-point analysis of what was wrong with the investigation of Kircher's murder. It could easily be the length of this book. I could also refer you to some of the most comprehensive scholarly analyses of the investigation's legal shortcomings, such as Peter Gill's meticulous Analysis and Implications of the Miscarriages of Justice of Amanda Knox and Raffaella Solicito in the July 2016 issue of the criminology journal Forensic Science International, which includes paragraphs like this.
The amplified DNA product in sample B was also subjected to capillary gel electrophoresis. The electrophoretic graph showed peaks that were below the reporting threshold and allele imbalance at most low-key. I counted only 6 alleles that were above the reporting threshold. The electrophoretic graph showed a partial DNA profile that was claimed to match Meredith Kircher. Consequently, sample B was borderline for interpretation.
Instead of all that, let me give you the simplest and shortest of all possible Amanda Knox theories. Her case is about transparency. If you believe that the way a stranger looks and acts is a reliable clue to the way they feel, if you buy into the friend's fallacy, then you're going to make mistakes. Amanda Knox was one of those mistakes. Let's return for a moment to the theories of Tim Levine that I talked about in Chapter 3. Levine, as you will recall, set up a sting operation for college students. He gave them a trivia test to do. In the middle of it, the instructor left the room, leaving the answers on her desk. Afterward, Levine interviewed the students and asked them point blank whether they had cheated. Some lied. Some told the truth. Then he showed videos of those interviews to people and asked them if they could spot the students who were lying. Social scientists have done versions of this kind of experiment for years. You have a sender, a subject, and a judge, and you measure how accurate the judge is at spotting the sender's lies. What Levine discovered is what psychologists always find in these cases, which is that most of us aren't very good at lie detection. On average, judges correctly identify liars 54% of the time, just slightly better than chance. This is true no matter who does the judging. Students are terrible. FBI agents are terrible. CIA officers are terrible. Lawyers are terrible. There may be a handful of super detectors who beat the odds, but if there are, they are rare. Why? The first answer is the one we talked about in Chapter 3. We're truth-biased. For what turns out to be good reasons, we give people the benefit of the doubt and assume the people we're talking to are being honest. But Levine wasn't satisfied with that explanation. The problem is clearly deeper than truth default. In particular, he was struck by the finding that lies are most often detected only after the fact, weeks, months, sometimes years later. For example, when Scott Carmichael said to Anna Montes during their first meeting, "Look, Anna, I have reason to suspect that you might be involved in a counterintelligence influence operation," she just sat there looking at him like a deer in the headlights. In retrospect, Carmichael believed that was a red flag. If she had been innocent, she would have said something, cried out, protested. But Montez, she, quote, didn't do a freaking thing except sit there. In the moment, however, Carmichael missed that clue. Montez was uncovered only by chance 4 years later. What Levine found is that we nearly always miss the crucial clues in the moment, and it puzzled him. Why? What happens at the moment someone tells a lie that specifically derails us?